McCallum prided themselves on efficiency, and principal photography was finished by the end of September. Nearly all of it was shot against a green screen, except for location shoots in Tunisia, once again standing in for Tatooine, and once again struck by a freak storm during shooting, Italy for Queen Amidala's palace, and a park in Watford, 10 minutes' drive from the studios. That was it. Lucas was perplexed when McGregor asked whether they'd be shooting the underwater scenes underwater. "This isn't real," the digital director reminded the actor. With a fledgling internet full of fans hunting for details on the movie, security was tight. Actors would only receive the pages of the scenes they were working on. All pages had to be returned at the end of the day. Everyone on set had to sign confidentiality agreements, for which Lucasfilm was fast becoming famous. The tightly controlled script was entirely Lucas's work, although that's not necessarily how he had wanted it. Young Indiana Jones writer Frank Darabont had at one point been approached to do a polish on the script, and he had agreed readily but never got the call. He did at least get to read the script and view a rough cut of the movie in advance. His fellow Young Indy alumnus, Jonathan Hale, was also mentioned by McCallum as a possible writer, but he wasn't even approached. Not for this movie, anyway. Meanwhile, apparently eager for his old protégé's help, Lucas approached Lawrence Kasdan in June, shortly before shooting began, and asked him to take a second pass at a script that was already on its fourth draft and about to be filmed. Kasdan gave a polite but firm no. It wasn't just that he was a director in his own right now. It was that, as a director, he recognized that it was important for this whole trilogy of prequels to kick off exactly according to Lucas's vision. "I thought he should take responsibility and make exactly the movie he wanted to make," Kasdan told Eon magazine. And that's exactly what he did. Lucas later rationalized it. Sure, Kasdan could write better dialogue and better transitions, he said, but Lucas realized Kasdan would have insisted on what a lot of Lucas's friends were already telling him. Don't start the prequels with the story of a 9-year-old boy. In London, Lucas spent more time in closed-circuit video conference calls with ILM back in San Rafael than he did directing the actors. The ILM-Lucas nexus was intended to be a symbiotic relationship of the kind the film was constantly referencing. ILM would create the digital background, Lucas would approve it, and fresh from that meeting, he would describe to the actors what they were going to be playing against. ILM was feeling the pressure of 1,900 special effects shots, many of them featuring a kind of effect never done before. Notes were taped to doors, quoting McCallum, "The film is going to come out in May 1999, no matter what." It wasn't exactly a recipe for success. The set could feel like a prison. The actors were chosen for their names and past performances, rather than their chemistry with each other. They had not been allowed to read the entire script, had no real idea what the story was, and barely even knew what environment they were supposed to be standing in. The film's director hadn't directed in 22 years. He tended to retreat into documentary style, just letting the actors do it the way they were going to do it, and was far more concerned about the technology he was using and its impact on the world than he was about the human dimensions of the film itself. "I definitely feel a part of the transformation of cinema," Lucas told a press conference in July. He fixated on details like whether Jar Jar was going to be an entirely CGI character, or whether some of actor Ahmed Best's on-set suit was going to have to be used for more than reference. "That take Natalie Portman just did? Great," Lucas surmised, walking away from the set with McCallum one day early in the shoot. "Just great." Portman and her fellow actors, fully aware of history's gaze, were stiffening up and giving the most somber performances of their careers. If they hadn't been instructed to speak in monotone, they were doing a good impression of it. But that was okay, because the director, who admitted he writes wooden dialogue and whose script had been vetted by precisely no one, wasn't listening to the words. To him, this was music, a tone poem, a silent movie. Perhaps the actors should have challenged him the way Harrison Ford used to. Perhaps they should have worked their lines a little like Alec Guinness. But any such innovation was tough, even for the veteran actors, given their separation from each other. Terrence Stamp, playing the outgoing Chancellor of the Galactic Senate opposite Natalie Portman, never actually worked with Portman. He had to emote to a piece of paper that marked where she would be standing. Besides, at this stage in the creator's career, which of the actors would dare talk back? "Now he's so exalted," Mark Hamill lamented about Lucas in 2005, "that no one tells him anything. Better to make their physical performance really sing. Swing those lightsabers, boys." One actor who thrived on set, martial arts expert Ray Park, who played the dual lightsaber-wielding villain Darth Maul. It wasn't just that the actors were being asked to perform in what was surely the most sterile, stilted environment of their careers. The film's producer agreed with everything the director wanted, and he would move heaven and earth to make it happen. The film's key performance came from a 9-year-old boy. Jake Lloyd was carrying the weight of the film and needed to convince the audience his character is something special, the product of a literal virgin birth, a potential Darth Vader. Yet there he was, suffering from exhaustion in 125-degree Tunisian heat. The first generation of Star Wars fans, meanwhile, had been ginned up by the special editions and had inducted a new generation of fans, their kids, in the process. The media, especially a nascent online media, was chomping at the bit for a single grainy photo from the set. It was a level of anticipation few movies in history could actually have met. In retrospect, it's amazing Episode 1 turned out as well as it did. In early 1999, ILM hosted a screening of the rough cut of what had now been named The Phantom Menace, a name reminiscent of the radio serials Lucas listened to as a kid. Documentary cameras caught the pall that descended over the viewers, Lucas's brain trust, as the credits rolled and the lights went up. They caught anxious looks and hair pulling. After a few moments, Lucas speaks, "It's bold in terms of jerking people around, but I may have gone too far in a few places." Sound designer Ben Burtt, one of the longest-serving and most trusted Lucasfilm employees in the room, offers this reaction. "In the space of 90 seconds, you go from lamenting the death of a hero, to escape, to slightly comedic with Jar Jar, to Anakin returning. It's a lot." "It boggles the mind," Lucas admits. "I've thought about this quite a bit, and the tricky part is you can't take any of those pieces out." They were talking about the final few reels of the movie, which intercut four scenes. The Jedi versus Darth Maul, Anakin versus the Trade Federation station, Team Amidala versus the Trade Federation, Gungans versus the battle droids. It's an incredibly ambitious sequence, and yet Lucas was locked into its structure, which had become part of a pattern. The first Star Wars movie had one action scene at the end, the attack on the Death Star, spliced with reaction shots on board the station and back at the Rebel base. Empire intercut two action scenes at the end: Luke's lightsaber battle with Vader, and Leia, Chewie, and Lando escaping Cloud City. Return of the Jedi ended on three simultaneous action sequences: Han and Leia and the Ewoks on the moon of Endor, Luke, Vader, and the Emperor battling it out aboard the second Death Star, Lando leading the Rebel fleet's assault on the fully operational battle station. So how could Phantom Menace not attempt to intercut four action sequences? And yet even Lucas, who had been driving his special effects company to do the impossible for the past 2 years, seemed to know this was a step too far. To McCallum, shortly after the screening, Lucas expanded his comments to the film as a whole. "It is a very hard movie to follow," he said. "I have done it more extremely than I did in the past. It's stylistically designed to be that way, and you can't undo that, but you can diminish the effects of it. We can slow it down a little bit." For the first time in his career, then, the faster and more intense director set about making a movie slower and less intense. At the same time, scenes that could do with a little more speed and intensity, specifically the sitting around and talking scenes on Coruscant and in the Galactic Senate, were kept pretty much as they were. With 4 weeks to go, ILM was still working on the final parade scene. Sound editing continued until a week before release. Even with all the resources of Skywalker Ranch, with tech geniuses and animation gurus aplenty, another Star Wars movie went down to the wire in almost the same way as the first. This time, the fans came to the Coronet early, more than a month ahead of the first screening on May 19, 1999. They came from all over. Chris Giunta moved from Maryland to San Francisco with his girlfriend, Beth, specifically so he could see Episode 1 at the theater where George Lucas liked to hold screenings, the theater that had become famous among fans, the Coronet, ground zero for the Star Wars phenomenon. Giunta found a job at Bank of America fixing ATMs and told his boss when he started that he would have to take off most of April and May 1999. When his boss found out why, he laughed and then asked, "Can you get me a ticket?" In early April, Giunta started driving past the Coronet every other day to see if the line had begun. When he saw a tent appear for the first time, he rushed home to get his own camping gear. He returned to the Coronet, but the others had mysteriously vanished. The lady at the box office had no idea where they'd gone, but she saw no problem with him pitching his own tent at what was, presumably, the front of the line. Giunta slept there overnight and had just eaten his packed breakfast when a sedan rolled up hard, jumping the curb in front of him. A couple of guys shot out and started grilling Giunta. "Who are you? Why are you here? What group are you with?" This was Frank Parisi, a video game reviewer, and his friend, Shanti Siegel. They had spent the last 6 months planning their Phantom Menace line strategy, mostly with a group called the Fraternal Order of Bounty Hunters. The friends had met and bonded on this very spot outside the Coronet for the special editions, near the front of the line. Siegel had been going to the Coronet since he saw Empire Strikes Back there at the age of 4 and loved one seat in the theater more than any other. Third row, seat 6. So much that he'd carved his name into it years before. Everybody had different motivations for why they were planning to camp out, Siegel says. Some people wanted to be first. Some people wanted to do it for the glory. Some people just wanted to have fun. I didn't give a shit about any of that. I just needed to make sure I got to sit in my seat for the opening show. Siegel kept upping the ante on how early he, Parisi, and another friend would start camping out. Figuring everyone would arrive with tents in tow a month beforehand, including the bounty hunters, whom they could get a jump on, Siegel finally settled on a start date of 11 p.m. on April 15, or 6 weeks ahead of the release date. He was right. They were first. The trio stayed there for all of 2 days before the police kicked them off the sidewalk. Giunta had showed up 2 days after that, when Parisi spotted him and called Siegel, and that's when they did their Starsky and Hutch act with the car on the sidewalk. "Once we found out he was just some screwball lone wolf," Siegel says, "we immediately dropped our guard and befriended him." They all camped out together that night, and then the police kicked them all off again in the morning. That's when another faction appeared on the scene, comprised of followers of Counting Down, a now-defunct website that began as little more than a big clock ticking down the hours until the first midnight showing of The Phantom Menace. It soon became a clearinghouse for rumors about the movie. A nascent online community for the mostly male 20-somethings camping out in New York, L.A., and San Francisco. More importantly, the Counting Down guys were the only ones with the foresight to get a $700 urban camping permit from City Hall before they pitched their tents outside the Coronet. Team Counting Down invited all the other early campers to a summit meeting at the Round Table Pizza next door to the Coronet. The factions of this fractious line were invited to unite. They devised a shift system. Everyone who took a 25-hour shift over the coming month would get one ticket. Giunta needed 12 tickets, so he signed up for 12 shifts. Everyone called him crazy. "Well," he explained, "I was going to do more than that anyway." Siegel declared that any night anyone else was camping, he would be there too. Parisi came to the Coronet most days and kept Giunta company, talking movies. Some local hippie mom dropped her kid off at the line during the day. The line judged him the spitting image of Anakin Skywalker. "The kid goes to the front of the line," declared Parisi. Lil Anakin became a mascot. He forced the rest of the waiting fans to maintain good behavior and to tone down the drinking a notch or two. The truce of the factions held. The line endured chilly summer wind and relentless fog. "It was nightmarish at night," said Todd Evans, one of the counting down guys who became best friends with Parisi. "But it was like summer camp for movie fiends." They stood firm when drivers on Geary stopped and yelled, "Get a life!" They weathered drive-by water balloonings and, on one particularly sticky occasion, an attack with a balloon filled with maple syrup. They took it in their stride when a local radio station, Wild 107, paid Star Wars fan Kari Crazy K. Crowder to camp outside the Coronet for a month in a well-appointed luxury van. The final indignity of the line warrior struggle was that there wasn't even anything good on at the Coronet during that long month. Only a Hollywood horror comedy, with all the quality that implies, a critical and commercial flop called Idle Hands. It was so bad, in fact, that Evans tried to watch it and left, preferring to sleep outside in the blustery cold. "And I never walk out of movies," he says. If any passerby was ignorant enough to ask what they were waiting for, they'd point to the marquee. "Idle Hands," they'd say deadpan. "We're camping out for tickets to Idle Hands." Word of the line soon spread. Asian tourists came by the busload to take pictures of the happy few line warriors, one of whom, Travis, began making himself up as a note-perfect Darth Maul, yellow contacts and all. "We started to be the backdrop for local news," remembers Junta. Roundtable offered the line-goers free pizza. The owner of a local bagel shop gave them a place to shower above the store. REI donated tents. IBM gave the line 3 ThinkPad laptops to share. Counting Down installed a T1 line in a nearby copy shop and ran cables out the front door so the line had high-speed internet, still a rarity in 1999. And what did the guys in line do with all this equipment? They watched a pirated copy of the Star Wars Holiday Special. The number of the payphone next to the Coronet was posted on Counting Down. Fans would call from as far away as Ireland, and the group outside the theater would take turns answering it. A rather odd young guy just out of high school named A.J. Napper ran up and down the line yelling, reenacting Han Solo's famous Death Star battle cry as he chased, and was then chased by, a contingent of stormtroopers. AJ started doing it every hour on the hour to relieve the monotony. Eventually, someone felt compelled to trip him up. Most evenings, they'd all go to a dive bar over on Clement Street called The Other Place. The bartender gave all line warriors a 50% discount, and they invented a signature cocktail, the Flaming Darth Maul. Aftershock, Jägermeister, and or black vodka, and 151 rum on the top so you could set it on fire. Parisi got twisted drunk and stood on the bar tearing his shirt off and toasting, "To all my friends!" Siegel downed enough drinks another night that he almost considered letting a friend drive him home. Luckily, Junta reminded him that his place was in the line, and Siegel was able to stagger back to his tent before passing out. "Had he left, I would have regretted it to this day," Siegel says. A week before the midnight show came the great temptation. The Coronet hosted a special cast and crew screening for ILM and assorted VIPs. George Lucas showed up with his kids and shook a few hands. Everyone in the line tried desperately to play it cool, but some remember AJ rushing up to and gushing over Lucas. Robin Williams had a cunning tactic for getting in unmolested. He had a guy approach the theater dressed as Robbie the Robot from Forbidden Planet while Williams attempted to run in undercover. But AJ tracked him down too. Then, when all the celebrities and employees were inside and the doors shut, a Lucasfilm rep whispered to the kid and the guys at the front, "Okay, there are a few seats left. Go in if you want." Tickets to an exclusive after-party at the Marin Civic Center were included in the deal. The members of the line paused. Everybody looked at each other and said, "These people are brothers in arms. committed to standing there every single day, rain or shine, Evans remembered. They made a pact. Anyone who went in now would be out of the opening night line. Still, a whole bunch of line warriors took the Faustian bargain, including the kid. Lil Anakin went to the dark side, they said. Those who went into the cast and crew screening missed a key warning sign. Francis Coppola exiting the theater with a large cigar, with which he proceeded to take a half-hour break. Junta tried sneakily taking a selfie with his favorite director in the world in the background, but Coppola came up and smacked him. "If you want a proper picture, come over here," he said. The line got its fill of photos and then asked, "Why was he missing the movie?" Coppola shrugged. "I've seen bits of it before." Bits of it? Why wouldn't he want to watch all of it? But this was a time of innocence, a time of the firm belief that anything with the name Star Wars had to be golden, and so the line shrugged and kept on waiting. Those who remained in line throughout the screening would receive incredible gifts from Lucasfilm. Events manager Mary Franklin, a veteran of the Star Wars Online fan club and first editor of Bantha Tracks, drove a pickup truck to the Coronet with a 6-foot chunk of the original foam core Death Star trench from 1977. She took a hacksaw and started dispensing pieces of it to the line, which received it as if it were the true cross. Lucas had a Chewbacca-shaped chocolate ice cream cake delivered to the line. Producer Rick McCallum came to hang out with the guys a few times. Junta got a special FedEx delivery to the line from his mom and hid it from Beth when she came to visit. But the fans who resisted the urge to enter the theater also had to suffer spoilers, particularly the moment when Lil Anakin, whom they couldn't shoo away, pointed to Travis dressed as Darth Maul and screamed, "You die!" The line warriors drew a collective sharp intake of breath. Finally, the big day arrived. Evans coordinated a costume contest, judged by the cross-dressing sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, a San Francisco institution. Naturally, Travis, as Darth Maul, won. A dot-com founder came by. This was the height of the dot-com era, and gave everyone multicolored lightsabers. Evans dressed for the evening in tuxedo, though it was hard to maintain a cool facade. Frank started doing this nervous bouncing like a fighter before his Vegas title fight, just twitching with anticipation, and I was feeding off him, said Evans. When they opened the doors, no one can quite remember who was first in. Some say it was Crazy K from the radio station, carrying Lil Anakin in his arms. Parisi beat Evans in the door, but Parisi stopped to kiss the carpet in the lobby, and Evans ran straight past him. Once inside the theater, the crowd was manic with excitement. The line warriors had an hour of mock lightsaber battles. One guy, who'd perversely dressed as Captain Picard from Star Trek, was chased up and down the aisles. Finally, they sat and chanted for the movie they wanted. "Idle hands! Idle hands!" Chris Junta, who had served those extra shifts so he could bring his girlfriend, Beth, and 10 other friends to the screening, had a surprise in store for Beth and the rest of the fans. Rick McCallum showed up at the front of the theater. The producer took one look at the packed house, the first in San Francisco to see the movie he'd worked on for nearly 5 years, and spread his arms wide. "This is fucking awesome!" The line warriors cheered. Then McCallum asked if there was a Beth in the house. "I hate you," Junta's girlfriend whispered, smiling, crying. Junta, wearing Jedi robes, brought her up to the front of the theater and proposed to her with the ring his grandmother wore, the ring his mother had FedExed to the line. Beth said yes. The line warriors exploded. They ran out of the preferred seats they'd been planning and arguing over for months and rushed the couple in a giant group hug. You could not have asked for an audience in a better mood as the lights went down and the Fox fanfare began. "Electricity was tingling in everyone's fingers," remembers Evans. "It was like the Big Bang, all this kinetic energy exploding in one giant release of fanboys all over the audience. Just this giant psychic orgasm." Like all good things, the elation didn't last. After the movie, everyone trooped out of the theater, somewhat stunned. Outside, a TV crew was interviewing the luminaries of the line. What did they think? Was it all worth it? Junta, his new fiancée on his arm, said he'd have to see it again to form an opinion. Evans still had images of pod racing and lightsabers dancing in his head, and no coherent opinion just yet. Only one guy provided a concise soundbite. At 15 years' distance, no one can quite remember who it was. Junta thought it was Parisi, who thought it was Siegel, who thought it was Travis. But they all remember what he said. The moment this aggrieved fan pushed past his friends, looked straight in the camera, and offered a choice three-word review of episode one. "Shit fucking sandwich," he yelled, and sulked off into the night. 23. The prequels conquer Star Wars. On May 25, 1977, the day the first Star Wars film had been released, the San Francisco Chronicle didn't mention the film until page 51. On May 19, 1999, by contrast, the paper was shot through with it. The NATO bombing of Kosovo, President Clinton's $15 billion spending request, the passage of a post-Columbine bill on child safety handgun locks. None of this made the front page. Instead, a giant headline wondered where the reclusive Lucas had gone on his big day. Back to Hawaii? In fact, he was preparing for a vacation to Europe with his kids. Inside the Chronicle, readers could find an editorial titled, "May the Hype Be With You," and an editorial cartoon showing a world filled with Star Wars signage. The city's board of supervisors had just voted in a ban on the sale of laser pointers to children because parents believe these pointers can help their children imitate Luke Skywalker, placing them at increased risk of blinding each other. A giant feature marveled at the 2,200 special effects shots in the movie and wondered, as everyone in the industry was wondering, whether cinema had just effectively gone digital. In fact, less of the movie was constructed by computers than viewers suspected. The spaceship models were still real, and the world was years away from the debut of CGI Yoda. The movie's soundtrack was reviewed in the arts section. The score's most delightful stretch is the bouncy, undulating stroll associated with Jar Jar Binks, the Gungan with attitude, it enthused. At the other end of the emotional spectrum, John Williams's Duel of the Fates had already become the first classical work in MTV's music video rotation. It was bombastic, ominous, choral, and it would inspire the presence of apocalyptic choirs in Hollywood soundtracks for years to come. Williams's music, the oxygen of Star Wars, was still operating at peak flow. The scene at the coronet had been repeated across the country. Every local news outfit had a reporter standing in front of the lines of lawn chairs and sleeping bags. Many had helicopters flying overhead. One Oregon station ran this shocking news. A local theater had only four fans camping outside. In 1977, Star Wars had opened on 32 screens. In 1999, The Phantom Menace opened on 7,700. Fox spent around $50 million advertising it, which was actually a low figure for such a major movie. The media was doing its job for them. That helped, because Fox was only getting 7.5% of the ticket gross, less than a third of its regular percentage. And Lucas? It was widely believed that the movie was about to make him a billionaire. Lucas may have already passed that milestone by this point, based purely on the merchandising deals. Hasbro paid $400 million for the rights to make toys based on the movie, and they weren't even exclusive rights. Lego had jumped into the Star Wars universe with the first licensing deal in the Danish toy giant's 50-year history. This despite the fact that one of the company's vice presidents had declared 2 years earlier that Lego would license Star Wars over my dead body. The CEO, himself a Star Wars fan, won his executives over by commissioning surveys of parents in the United States and Germany that revealed a vast majority would purchase Lego Star Wars sets if they were available. Sure enough, more than $2 billion worth of Star Wars Legos were sold in 1999 and 2000, helping to pull the company back into profitability. Toys R Us and FAO Schwartz held their first midnight openings, an event called Midnight Madness, in May 1999, at which all of these new toys were made available at once. Even the Coronet Line Warriors turned up at the local store en masse. There were 73 other official Star Wars licensees. Not all of them were aimed at children. Yves Saint Laurent, for example, produced Queen Amidala makeup. Plenty more ideas were left on the table. The world would never see the gurgling Gungan squeezable plastic heads or ripcord pod racer toys dreamed up by one agency for the Pepsi Episode 1 promotions. Even so, Steve Sansweet called the resulting flow of merchandise a flood of biblical proportions. Pepsi produced an incredible 8 billion cans of Episode 1 soda. Instead of a golden ticket, there were 250,000 gold-colored cans of Yoda-themed Pepsi. These were worth $20 if you mailed them in. A decade that had begun with Star Wars fans essentially in hiding would end with more Star Wars characters printed on aluminum cans than there were people on the planet. Star Wars fan club membership reached its zenith around the time of the Episode 1 release. Dan Madsen was mailing 2 million copies a month of Star Wars Insider, the new name for the Lucasfilm fan club magazine. For comparison, he mailed 500,000 copies of Star Trek Communicator a month. In April 1999, Madsen was also the instigator of the first Star Wars celebration, a three-day event at the Air and Space Museum in Denver. It was the first licensed Lucasfilm gathering of fans, all of it intended to promote Episode 1. Madsen and his tireless MC, Anthony Daniels, paved the way for 20,000 fans from around the world to gather in Denver. There was a torrential downpour, and the vendor tents began leaking. Still, there they were, thousands of Star Wars addicts calling friends back home on chunky cell phones about the short extracts from the movie being screened. Such previewed scenes from Episode 1 were the subject of intense deconstruction, as were the trailers. The first Phantom Menace trailer debuted online and was downloaded 10 million times. That may not make it sound like a big deal in the age of YouTube, but in 1998, when less than a third of Americans were online, nearly all of them on horrifically slow 56K connections, it was huge. Downloading a video could take hours. Meanwhile, hardcore fans would pay for Meet Joe Black and The Waterboy and then try to claim their money back before the movie started, because these were the movies before which the Phantom Menace trailer appeared. Theaters soon caught on and refused refunds. But for the fans desperate for the smallest crumb of detail, it was worth it for the stories you could tell yourself based on this imagery. A queen in council, a field full of droids, a shining city on a waterfall. The idea of Star Wars was back. And how? Once the movie was out, many hardcore fans would need to see Phantom Menace a number of times. Casual viewers wanted to see it at least once, just to find out for themselves what all the fuss was about. Workplace consultants Challenger, Gray, and Christmas estimated that 2.2 million employees in the United States alone skipped work on May 19 to see it. Some bosses simply declared a Star Wars holiday. The movie grossed $28.5 million in ticket sales on opening day, a new record. The negative reviews were already starting to arrive by that point, but it didn't seem to matter. Time and Newsweek, both of which had raved about the original Star Wars, gave Phantom Menace the thumbs down. The actors are wallpaper. The jokes are juvenile. There's no romance, and the dialogue lands with the thud of a computer instruction manual, thundered Peter Travers in Rolling Stone. Joyless, overly reverential, and impenetrably plotted, concluded the Washington Post. Variety complained that the movie lacked any emotional pull, wonder, or awe. There were quite a few positive reviews, though, including one from the biggest name in criticism. Roger Ebert had been personally briefed by Lucas and was on the director's wavelength. Dialogue isn't the point, he insisted. These movies are about new things to look at. At first, moviegoers seemed to agree with Ebert. Gallup released a Phantom Menace poll. In fact, Gallup released 3 Phantom Menace polls, because that's how big a deal the franchise was, taken between May 21 and June 19, 1999. In the first poll, 52% of people who saw the movie described it as excellent. By the third poll, that number had fallen to 33%, but most of the balance had shifted into the good category. The percentage of people describing the movie as poor never went above 6%, about the same as the percentage of respondents calling it one of the greatest movies I've ever seen. Negative reviews may have slowed ticket sales, but only in the sense that a pile of sandbags can slow a tsunami. Pre-release estimates put the opening weekend gross at between $100 million and $190 million. As it turned out, Phantom took a week to reach $134 million, but the film was raking in money all the same. "It's entirely critic-proof," said NPR film critic Elvis Mitchell, who wasn't a fan. "It doesn't matter if this movie is basically like an intergalactic version of C-SPAN. They're talking about treaties for 2 hours. No. People will go. They want to see it because they want to be part of the phenomenon." Phantom Menace was the biggest movie of 1999 and, unadjusted for inflation, the biggest Star Wars movie ever. It grossed $431 million in the United States, but $552 million in the rest of the world. The first movie in the saga for which the foreign take beat the American. It made most of its money in countries where most of the audience were reading subtitles and didn't care about the delivery of the dialogue anyway. I spent a good part of Star Wars Celebration Europe in 2013 drinking with German fans who raved about how much they loved Episode 1. Japan in particular went nuts for the film. The gross in that country alone, $110 million, almost equaled Lucas's entire budget. For Lucas, who had never cared for critics, the international success of Episode 1 amounted to a vindication. He didn't much care for the Academy either. So the fact that Phantom Menace lost the 2000 visual effects Oscar to The Matrix would have been a minor annoyance. The box office didn't lie. He was on the right track, playing the right music, so to speak. Episode 1 was a visual spectacular. The dialogue didn't matter. If the actors were always going to be upstaged by the effects, why worry about the acting? Best to stick with the silent movie/symphony concept. It seemed to have worked so well, in fact, that Lucas wasted no time in putting it to work again, this time with even more gusto. In August 1999, some 3 months after the premiere of Episode 1, Lucas and his kids returned from their European travels. In September, Lucas began to write Episode 2. The moment was once again captured by Lucasfilm cameras. The footage they recorded belied McCallum's claim in May 1999 that Lucas was about a quarter of the way through the script of Episode 2 and would have it done in September. This discrepancy would not have been the biggest deal, except for the fact that production on the new film was already in motion. The stage had been booked. Filming was due to start, in Australia this time, where tax breaks and tech-savvy workers had also attracted the makers of The Matrix, in June 2000. McCallum spent most of fall 1999 on planes to and from Sydney, racking up 90,000 air miles in the process. Lucas had spent 3 years writing and rewriting Episode 1. He would now have to turn out a script for Episode 2 in a mere 9 months. He sat down at the door desks in his writing tower, started on page 1, and working my way through a first draft as quickly as possible, he told author Jody Duncan. Then he started right away on a second draft. This would apparently be the second of a record number of drafts, 14 or 15, that Lucas wrote before he had the results typed up as a rough draft. He then did another 2 or 3 before having it typed up again as a second draft. We don't know how many penciled versions preceded the third draft. The next part of the chronology to be recorded in Lucasfilm lore is that the fourth draft was polished by young Indiana Jones writer Jonathan Hale, who had finally gotten that long-awaited call from Lucasfilm. Lucas estimated he'd done 20 rewrites of Episode 1 over 3 years. For episode 2, it appears he wrote 20 rewrites in 10 months, or a draft every 6 days, given that Lucas told Duncan he was only writing 3 days a week. This wasn't writing so much as live jazz performance. This time, Lucas seems to have been coping with the psychotic process of script writing by caring less about the actual outcome. Maybe that was the only way anyone could have done it, given the tremendous burden of expectations from Planet Star Wars. From the scripts that have leaked out of this production, which was even more secretive than Episode 1, it seems he was having his most fun writing Star Wars ever. He walked right up to the line of spoofing himself, Mad Magazine style, and then he stepped over it. Lucas's joking initial title for Star Wars Episode 2, which he stuck with for a number of drafts, was Jar Jar's Great Adventure, as if setting out to tweak older fanboys who were already fuming about the character. In early drafts, when Padme gets Jar Jar to fill in for her in the Galactic Senate, Lucas played with the notion that the Gungan can speak proper English when necessary. Padme, Representative Binks, I know I can count on you. Jar Jar, Yusa Betts and Misa Bottoms. Padme, what? Jar Jar, coughs, recovers. Oh, pardonnez, Senator. I mean, I am honored to accept this heavy burden. I take on this responsibility with deep humility, tinged with an overwhelming pride. The joke would disappear from later drafts. Jar Jar emerged as a dangerous dupe of Chancellor Palpatine, proposing emergency war powers to the Senate. Lucas was bending over backwards to find the most vital reason for Jar Jar to be in Star Wars in the first place. You think Jar Jar ruined the galaxy far, far away? Turns out, he literally did. There's more evidence for an increasingly carefree touch on the part of the creator. Obi-Wan Kenobi encounters a drug dealer in a bar hawking death sticks in his script. Lucas named the character Elian Sleazebegano. When Yoda encounters the separatist leader and secret Sith Lord Count Dooku, another so-dumb-it's-hilarious name, Lucas not only changed his mind about whether Yoda ever wielded a lightsaber, he insisted to Kasdan during the Return of the Jedi roundtable that the little green guy didn't fight. But in describing Yoda's style, he started to sound like an announcer on an old-time radio serial. Yoda attacks. He flies forward. Count Dooku is forced to retreat. Words are insufficient to describe the range and skill of Yoda's speed and swordplay. His lightsaber is a humming blur of light. Count Dooku's lightsaber is sent cartwheeling from his hand. He staggers back, gasping and spent, against the control panel. Yoda jumps onto Dooku's shoulders and is about to drive the lightsaber into the top of the Count's head. Yoda, the end for you, Count, this is. Count Dooku, not yet. It seemed Lucas had forgotten all Campbell-esque pretensions and was simply riffing on a theme of Flash Gordon. Words are insufficient to describe could also be translated as ILM insert fight sequence here. He admitted as much himself. This was much more like a movie from the 1930s than any of the others had been, Lucas said, with a slightly over-the-top poetic style. The title itself, Attack of the Clones, couldn't have been more Buck Rogers. Ewan McGregor's reaction, when he was told the title on the red carpet at another movie premiere, is that it? That's a terrible, terrible title. And if there were plot holes, then there were plot holes. There were more than enough of them in the 1930s, too. Lucas tap-danced past plot problems like Guido Anselmi, the fictional filmmaker in Fellini's 8½, another director caught up in making a strange movie about rocket ships. Since Lucas was so familiar with his material after so many drafts, he assumed the audience would easily see through the mystery that Obi-Wan spends much of the movie trying to solve. Who ordered up thousands of clone troopers? The proto-stormtroopers who were to arrive just in time to save the Jedi from the Separatists on the planet of Geonosis. The truth behind their mysterious makers seemed gapingly obvious to the creator. I was always worried in Episode 2 that I was giving away too much, he reflected in 2005, in terms of people asking questions about where did the clones really come from? Indeed, There was no mystery for anyone paying attention. Jango Fett, the bounty hunter who provides the DNA on which the clones, and his son Boba, are based, tells Obi-Wan he was recruited not by a long-lost Jedi Master, as Obi-Wan believed, but by a man called Tyrannus. Later on, the audience is told that Darth Tyrannus is Count Dooku's Sith name. Though the fact that the clone troopers would betray the Jedi was supposed to remain a mystery until the third movie, it's an outcome hiding in plain sight. Obi-Wan, surprisingly incurious about the whole Tyrannus thing, now appears to be as much of a dupe as Jar Jar. It could have been worse. The name of the lost Jedi Master who supposedly ordered the army was originally rendered as Sidodius, not a whole world away from Sidious, Palpatine's Sith name. Lucas evidently felt this was just a little too obvious for the audience, and that it made the Jedi into even more obvious dupes. But there was one typing error in a printed-up draft of the script, in which this never-seen character became Sifo-Dyas. Lucas liked that. The name stuck. The expanded universe did the rest of the work, and today, Jedi Master Sifo-Dyas is a full-fledged character with a lengthy Wikipedia entry. Spoiler alert, he was murdered by Count Dooku and his blood inserted into the cyborg Sith soldier General Grievous. Then there was the romance between Anakin and Padme, which lurches on for scene after painful scene. From the start of the Episode II process, Lucas knew he was trying to write an old-fashioned romance. He expressed concern that the young boys in his target audience would roll their eyes at its flowery nature. But that's not actually what we ended up with. The love scenes, in the eyes of most viewers, are more flummery than flowery. Here's a taste of the young couple's supposedly flirtatious banter, and this is from the final draft. Anakin, well, tell me, did you dream of power and politics when you were a little girl? Padme, laughing, no, that was the last thing I thought of. But the more history I studied, the more I realized how much good politicians could do. After school, I became a senatorial advisor with such a passion that before I knew it, I was elected queen. For the most part, it was because of my conviction that reform was possible. I wasn't the youngest queen ever elected, but now that I think back on it, I'm not sure I was old enough. I'm not sure I was ready. Anakin, the people you served thought you did a good job. I heard they tried to amend the Constitution so you could stay in office. Padme, popular rule is not democracy, Annie. It gives the people what they want, not what they need. And truthfully, I was relieved when my two terms were up. So were my parents. They worried about me during the blockade and couldn't wait for it all to be over. Actually, I was hoping to have a family by now. My sisters have the most amazing, wonderful kids, so when the Queen asked me to serve as senator, I couldn't refuse her. Anakin, I agree. I think the Republic needs you. I'm glad you chose to serve. I feel things are going to happen in our generation that will change the galaxy in profound ways. Padme, I think so too.
It would be hard to call this romance. Harder still to call it a kids' movie. It's barely even intergalactic C-SPAN. It might be nearer the mark to call it well-intentioned didactic dullness. It reminds us of Luke Starkiller in the second draft of The Star Wars, delivering pages of explanation to his younger brothers about the history of the gangsters in the Galactic Senate. Lucas, no romance novelist he, originally had the couple marry in the middle of the movie rather than the end. As many rewrites as the script for Episode II apparently went through, Lucas still didn't turn over a single type draft to his staff during the entire pre-production process. This was a step beyond only giving actors the pages they needed. The entire movie was unknown to almost everyone involved until Lucas got on a plane to Australia for the beginning of the shoot.
An army of designers was stuck creating planets and creatures without having any idea where they would fit or how long they would be featured on the screen.
McCallum, the producer, who never says no, was stuck trying to make a budget without being able to itemize everything he was budgeting for. Lucas was playing jazz, bouncing back and forth from the design team's artwork, gaining inspiration for the script from the rest of Lucasfilm rather than the other way around.
McCallum made light of the situation in an interview with Star Wars Insider in January 2000. "Right now we don't need a script," he said. "It's better for Lucas to concentrate on the dialogue and themes as he goes along, while we're working on the look. The script would be completed whenever George hands it to me." McCallum compared Episode 2 to Citizen Kane, the script for which Orson Welles finished 2 days before filming began. "We're not putting any pressure on him," he added. Even when Lucas handed over the typed version of the final script, it wasn't finished. That was when he had Jonathan Hales do his polish, working remotely from London. On set, Lucas went over Hales's quickly assembled draft, rewrote it, and finally delivered it to the crew 3 days ahead of the first shot. Not quite, but almost matching Welles's record. Even after the shoot, Lucas wasn't satisfied with the script and tried to flesh out the character of Count Dooku by inserting dialogue making him Qui-Gon's former master. The key actor for Episode 2, Canadian unknown Hayden Christensen, had been cast for the role of the adolescent Anakin Skywalker without reading a word of the story. When he finally saw the script, the new Anakin blanched. "The dialogue was, well, I didn't know how I could make it convincing," he recalled in 2005. "Finally, I just said to myself, I am George's voice. This is his vision, and I'm here to fulfill it. And that's how we worked." We're a long way from the days of, "You can type this shit, George, but you can't say it." And so the shoot proceeded, from June to September 2000, with an army of artists and engineers attempting to fulfill Lucas's vision. He himself was most concerned with his latest technological milestone, creating the first movie shot entirely digitally. He had gone to Sony and Panasonic and urged them to create a camera that was up to the task. What came back was the Sony HDCF900, a digital camera that took 24 high-definition shots a second. But ILM was given less than 24 hours to vet the camera before it left for Sydney and was horrified at the shots that came back. The camera compressed its blue channel data to roughly a quarter of the regular red and green size, which would have been of minor concern had most of the movie not been shot against a blue screen. To all intents and purposes, Lucas might as well not have used the blue screen at all. Dozens of artists and image specialists had to apply hundreds of painstaking fixes to what they called garbage. Yet to Lucas, visual effects existed in an opaque box. ILM staffers remember John Knoll, co-creator of Photoshop, and the movie's visual effects supervisor being frustrated about the limited number of times he could intercede with the creator on digital matters, after which Knoll felt he would have to shut up for a few days. After the hoopla of Phantom Menace, the Attack of the Clones release on May 16, 2002 was a relatively subdued affair, at least in the United States. It opened on roughly half the number of screens, 3,161, with relatively little advertising and no fast food tie-ins. Still, at first, Episode 2 did even better than its predecessor, scoring a 4-day gross of $116 million, the same as the movie's budget. For the first time, a Star Wars movie was opening all around the world simultaneously in more than 70 countries. Add a $67 million international opening weekend, and it became clear those merchandising deals hadn't been necessary anyway. While some critics felt the movie was an improvement on Phantom Menace, most reviewed Attack of the Clones even more poorly than its predecessor. Based on the Top Critics section of the reviews website Rotten Tomatoes, Clones is the least well-reviewed of the first 6 episodes, with a 37% fresh rating. No one doubted the movie would make buckets of cash regardless, and the reviewers showed a kind of resignation in their despair. For the first time, Star Wars was compared unfavorably to the Flash Gordon serials. "The screenplay would make Buster Crabbe call for a rewrite," wrote Michael Atkinson in the Village Voice. Figuring out where the Republic, the Federation, the Corporate Alliance, and the trade guilds begin and end is more than Lucas himself manages to do.
And the endless exposition is such irritating gibberish that you're prone to ignore it and look out the windows as the digital planes sail by. When I was a kid in school, we called this tedium. Today, it's a secular theophany. Taken as five films, or six in a year or so, this is hardly an epic, a word that implies moral, human, and social weight. It's a marathon of irrelevant pre-adolescent dreaming. One could maintain that Lucas's ongoing opus will eventually juice more consumers than any other cultural manifestation in the history of the race besides the Bible. At the very least, if a Jedi emissary were to examine mankind through its most widely perused texts, Lucas's massive fantasy would surely stand in the top five.
Stop the planet. I want to get off.
There were points of light in the critical darkness. The lightsaber battle between Dooku and CGI Yoda won praise for being unexpected and effective. You'll believe a small green guy can fly. Then there was the hellish ending. Legions of clones assembling under dark red lights on Geonosis, the largest digital army ever seen on screen. In the years since the first trilogy, fans had assumed that those clones we'd been hearing about, the Clone Wars that Lucas kept off limits to other writers, were some kind of external invasion. As a title, Attack of the Clones enforced that misdirection. Now, it turned out that the clones were space soldiers, proto-stormtroopers, and they fought on the side of the good guys. I was wonderfully blindsided by the reveal in Clones, says author Timothy Zahn. Well played, George. Well played. Again, poor reviews bounced right off Lucasfilm like it was Teflon. Riding high on another successful movie, the company spun off its theater sound division, THX, as a separate private company, in which Lucas held a minority stake. Lucasfilm was evolving in other ways, too. Lucas moved most divisions of his company into Red Rock Ranch, just down the road from Skywalker Ranch, because it was getting too big for Skywalker to contain. ILM maxed out at around 1,500 employees. Lucas signed a lease to build a new headquarters in San Francisco. Lucas Books, meanwhile, was busily divvying up the expanded universe into specific eras spanning thousands of years. The Old Republic, Fall of the Republic, The Rebellion, The New Republic, The New Jedi Order. It was a smart way to diversify Star Wars holdings at a crucial moment. Not a fan of the prequels? You could still find something to love in these other areas of the galaxy's long history. The Old Republic era, a 24,000-year period when Jedi and Sith were fighting epic battles in much greater numbers than in the prequels, proved particularly popular in spin-off media such as the Tales of the Jedi comics, the award-winning 2003 role-playing game Knights of the Old Republic, and the massively multiplayer online game The Old Republic, which gained 1 million players within weeks of its launch. Internal Star Wars history was further brought into line at Lucasfilm with the creation of the Holocron, a database that not only listed all the characters, planets, ships, and concepts in the series so far, but stated what level of canon they were. The highest level was G-canon, which stands for George, the movies and anything Lucas was directly involved in. The lowest level was S-canon, which might as well stand for stupid. The holiday special, alongside anything else from the early days when Lucasfilm wasn't paying quite so close attention. Until 2002, the continuity rules of Star Wars were dictated by the internally famous Black Binders, of which Lucas holds the original. Afterwards, it would all be digital in a surprisingly mundane-looking SQL database, just like millions of other collections of corporate assets on computers around the world. Lucasfilm employee Leland Chi created and manages the Holocron to this day. Officially, he is described as a continuity database administrator. Unofficially, he is the bearer of what Wired magazine dubbed the coolest job in the world. Chi was the one who had to work out small but vital matters such as how long it took the Millennium Falcon to travel from Hoth to Bespin. He typed in every one of the 15,000 Holocron entries, so it had a consistent voice. He was the one who had to decide just how important every single Star Wars character ever seen on screen or mentioned in a book is, on a scale of 1 to 4. Luke is obviously a 1, he says. A background character who doesn't even have a name is a 4. She wasn't a fan of either the latest works of G-Canon, episodes 1 or 2, when he set up the holocron.